metrics that are close to flat space. So literally, I'm going to write down g alpha beta equals our Minkowski metric plus small perturbations. And each one of those entries, each alpha beta, each entry in that matrix, I think of as being much less than 1. I didn't turn that out again. Okay.
Should write that on the board. Because this is just the diagonal minus plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. And so we want these to be smaller than that. Our vacuum equations are, again, r alpha beta equals 0. But because we're working in this approximation where these things are small, we're going to work to linear order. And so if I reduce or I keep only the terms in r alpha beta that are linear in h alpha beta, when I make this substitution in here, I ended up with an equation that looked like this. So there's a box acting on h alpha beta where that's the usual D'Alembertian, meaning the D'Alembertian in flat space. So there's minus dt squared plus grad squared, or del x squared plus del y squared plus del z squared. And then there were some extra bits left over that we combined together, or Hartle combines together to write as del alpha v beta, del beta v alpha, where that v, that new vector, is given here. It's the divergence of h, and then there's a gradient of the trace of h with this minus 1/2 factor stuck in there. And so our first exercise was to look at an improved Newtonian metric. And so what I want to do is I just want to solve this in a Newtonian limit where I've got a gravitational potential that doesn't depend on time. It only depends on x. In our previous discussions, when we were making this transition from Newtonian physics to space-time geometry, we had also, as well as saying that phi or phi over c squared was small, we'd also restricted the discussion to saying that velocities were small, which in some sense, well, in a very real sense, meant that the dx squared here is much smaller always than the dt squared over there. In this case, what we're thinking about is only weak fields, and so I'm not making any restriction about velocities, and I'm just solving this equation now. And what we ended up was adding an we reinstated this extra factor that appears all through the book. But with this extra factor, what we found, or this extra contribution in the spatial part of the metric, we found that this equation was satisfied. But it was satisfied sort of in bits and pieces. First of all, this term vanished because that equaling 0 was just basically given by del squared phi equals 0. And so that's our Newtonian equation in the absence of matter. And then it was a coincidence, or what we arranged was that we introduced the factor here to be precisely minus 2 so that when we looked at this vector, that all of those components, in fact, vanished. And so that was choosing a particular factor here. That wasn't physics. But since that vanishes, then these extra terms in our equation of motion necessarily vanish as well. And then I made the comment that this metric, if I think of phi as being minus m over r, or the potential around a spherical mass, then that metric matches the leading terms in the expansion of the Schwarzschild metric. But I have to think of the Schwarzschild metric in a specific coordinate system, namely these isotropic coordinates, where the spatial part looks like dx squared, dy squared, dz squared. If I tried to do that expansion on our usual Schwarzschild coordinates, of course, we'd get something that doesn't look like this at all, and so we couldn't make the comparison. But that reminds us then that there are all of these coordinate transformations that we were making in when we were working with the Schwarzschild geometry. And so we started to ask the question, well, how do those coordinate transformations play a role in the linearized equations? And so we had made some headway there. what we said was we wanted to not make general coordinate transformations. We were very creative in working with the Schwarzschild metric. But we wanted to make small coordinate transformations that would keep us in this ANSAT. So we can make coordinate transformations, but we want the metric still to be close to the flat space time metric. And so we can consider coordinate transformations where my x alphas transform to something that are basically, again, Cartesian coordinates, but we'll add a little function to those coordinates. I wrote it the other way around, sorry. So I started with the x's, I add to those x's some new functions, those new functions are small, and that defines a new set of coordinates. But then I want to turn it around in working with the metric or the line element. What I said is it's most useful to have x alpha, because then what we did is we replaced the dx alphas in our line element. And that would just amount to putting this thing on the other side of the equation. But there'd be an x there. I want everything here to be a function of y. But, well, y is just x plus corrections. So I write y here plus dot, dot, dot. And again, in the same way that we thought of these as being small, and so we only ever work to linear order in the metric perturbations, we're also going to think of these coordinate shifts as being small, and we're only going to work to linear order. And so what we did is we took this, we have dx alpha now being stuffed with dy's and derivatives of epsilons. We stuck that in the line element, and what we came up with was that we have a new metric that's, again, within this regime or in this ansatz, but the metric perturbations have been shifted by our coordinate transformation. And so there are two new contributions. And so this was the collection of metric perturbations in the x coordinates. That's where we started. And this was in the y coordinates. And so that's what the hat signifies, that I've just gone to this y coordinate system. And so this is the shift. And what I said was that that was analogous to something you see in electromagnetism. And in fact, I saw the words on the board, I think, what we call that in analogy, a gauge transformation. The idea being that in electromagnetism, we work with a four-vector potential, but there are lots of four-vector potentials that give us the same physical fields, the same electromagnetic or electric field and magnetic field. Here, what it is I have these metric perturbations, but there's some ambiguity in choosing those in that I get the same curvatures, or I get the same physics, space-time physics, with different choices of H. But those different choices just amount to making these coordinate transformations. And so there's an ambiguity, in any case, always in choosing what H is. And so how do we make that choice? Well, we choose at our convenience. We do something that's convenient. And so a convenient choice is the following. So making a choice is called, we can call it gauge fixing. To keep in with this language, or it's just choosing coordinates. So we were free to choose
for arbitrary functions. These epsilon alpha of x's. And so it seems that we have the freedom to fix four things in the problem. And so a convenient choice is to set these V alpha equal to 0. And so it's the counting seems right here. I mean, I have a collection of four functions here. I've got four free functions here. I ought to be able to make that choice to set those equal to 0. But just to check or to add some extra confidence, what we can do is we can ask, well, this is how, let's say I'm given H alpha beta that give me some V's, and those, that V is not 0. What coordinate choice would I make to set V in the hatted or in the y coordinates equal to 0? So V hat alpha would just be this divergence minus the gradient in the hatted coordinates. So I'm just going to plug this in. There's going to be a contribution. Well, I'll just write it out. So there's going to be a contribution here with the H's. And so those are just the old V's. And so we're assuming that, unfortunately, we made it, we wrote something down and those V's weren't 0 originally. But then there are these coordinate shifts that are making contributions. And so the first one, I'm taking a gradient of this on the first index. So that's going to give me a box in this case. And then here, I'm taking the divergence. Unfortunately, I'm taking the divergence with the second index. But if I switch the indices around, it'll give me the gradient of the divergence of epsilon. So I get two contributions, box, epsilon alpha minus del alpha divergence of epsilon. So that was just sticking those epsilon terms into the first here. The second term comes with a minus a half. I'm taking the trace of this and this. And so they're both giving me minus 2, the divergence. Or the sum is minus 2, the divergence of epsilon. And I'm supposed to take a gradient. So I stick in a del alpha of that. And so the nifty thing is that, well, the 2's cancel, the signs cancel. And so this is just del of the divergence. But here I've got minus del the divergence. And so those two terms cancel. And so if I want these to be set equal to 0, all I have to do then is satisfy this equation. But that equation amounts to saying, so this is saying if these are my old V's. They're some set of sources. And all I have to do is solve the wave equation for the epsilons, given that set of sources. And so that should give us extra confidence that that's a problem we're familiar with, solving the wave equation just in Minkowski space, that we're going to be able to find solutions to that equation. So are we happy with that? Which V? Oh, well, okay. This one? Yeah, sure. I want to go to some coordinate system where the V's are zero. So this is suggesting, or, you know, we had a counting argument here, but hopefully we've had experience solving wave equations. And so this is not an intimidating problem. It's something we are confident has solutions. But if we can do that, if we can set our V's to zero, that means that our linearized equation simplifies, again, just to the wave equation. So our linearized Einstein equation is now just box H alpha beta equals zero. So I'm solving the wave equation with no source. But I also have to keep in mind that I'm looking for solutions that satisfy this equals zero. And that choice of coordinates, or that condition that we're imposing on our solutions, is often called the gauge fixing condition. Or so this particular choice is something that's often called Lorentz gauge. Or we would say that this condition, this isn't a wave equation, but it's some differential condition. This condition is a Lorentz condition. Is the Lorentz gauge condition. But finding solutions then isn't that hard. At least there are a lot of simple solutions that we know about. And in particular, we can just say that we know there are plane wave solutions. Now, so in particular, then I might write H alpha beta equals A alpha beta. So that's just what I'll call the polarization tensor, but it's just a matrix of constants. And then the interesting time dependence I'll write as e to the I k dot x. Of course, that's a complex number. This is supposed to be a collection of real numbers, and so we take it with a grain of salt. Really, what we're going to write there is sines or cosines, but it's convenient to use the complex notation. Our wave equation then just says that box acting on H is zero. And so that's saying that k dot k is equal to zero, or that our plane wave is a null. Following a null direction. Here, let me write it. So if I act with box there, it just brings down two of the wave vectors, contracts them together, that's zero, it's a null vector, and so here's some solution. And so I can have plane waves propagating in arbitrary directions. However, we have to remember that I can't write down an arbitrary matrix here. After I choose my K, I have to make sure that the gauge condition is also satisfied. And so that's going to impose some constraints on the entries in that polarization tensor. And so our gauge condition is also going to demand that, well, if we just plug this ansatz into this, set it equal to zero, I'll just write out that I get something like that. And so this is saying if I pick a particular K, then I can't choose these alphas in an arbitrary way. And so there are restrictions on which of the H's or which of those plane waves or which polarization tensors I can choose. Yeah?
You have that K over there. Is this just true first order? Because your metric has this H after, so would that change your dot product?
No, okay. So when I'm manipulating these expressions, I'm always using the flat space metric. So for instance, this box, I just wrote minus dt squared plus dx squared. So I when I contracted indices there, I was just using A alpha beta. Similarly, when I'm doing contractions like this or taking the trace, I'm just, so it, yes, I guess the answer is yes. We're in the spirit of the this linearized analysis, all of the contractions that we're doing everywhere is just using an alpha beta in the flat space metric. What were we going to say next? Well, we've arrived at a remarkable result. Einstein's equations then supports waves in the space-time geometry. So even in the absence matter. So if I had an empty space in the Newtonian analysis, well, the only, if I had purely empty space, no matter sources anywhere in my Minkowski space, the only solution was that there was no gravitational field. But because this is a relativistic theory, I can have waves propagating across my Minkowski space, even without any sources. So this is perhaps what we expected. We produced a relativistic theory. So rather than getting just del squared there, we have a wave operator. And just like in electromagnetism, the simplest set of solutions that we can think about, or the simplest set of solutions for Maxwell's equations, are these plane waves. And so these are the analog of electromagnetic waves. Yeah?
A wave like that, I mean.
Chapter 23. Here, this would produce a gravitational wave. There was an accelerating object. In principle, that created gravitational waves. In practice, though, they were very small waves. And so those this linearized approximation is a good approximation there. But it's extremely difficult to detect those waves. And so the waves that people are hoping to detect are when you have much bigger masses, i.e. black holes and neutron stars colliding together. But, you know, when you were studying Maxwell's equations, you know, there we're happy just to talk about the waves in and of themselves. Studying the production of waves, how
you know, moving charges produce electromagnetic waves is sort of a higher order problem, and the same thing is true here. But we haven't quite. So this is a nice start, but we haven't quite got a very good. Well, we haven't got a very good physical intuition. I mean, there's some abstract formulas here. I guess this is something we have intuition for, but we'd like to have more intuition for the polarization tensor. And before I start writing out explicit polarization tensors, I have to tell you that, in fact, even though we've imposed this gauge condition, we haven't fixed the coordinate system completely. And so some of the solutions you write down here may just be gauge artifacts or, in fact, represent coordinate transformations. For example, we could consider the following. Imagine I chose A alpha beta to be equal to K alpha B beta plus K beta V alpha. Would anybody like to comment on this particular choice of polarization tensor? Is it going to satisfy our gauge condition? Who'd like to guess? I don't actually know the answer. I'm making this up. But given that I wrote it on the board, psychologically, I must be pretty confident that it does. So let's give it a try. I'm supposed to do this. And so I'm supposed to take K alpha beta. What's that equal to? Well, that's going to be K alpha here contracted with K alpha. So there's going to, well, I'll write it K alpha, V beta. And then the second contribution, I'm going to get a K beta. And there's a K dotted into a V. So I can write this K dot K. And then I'm supposed to have a term minus 1/2 K beta. And the trace of our polarization tensor. So this is minus 1/2 K beta. I'm going to take the trace. Again, I'm just taking the trace with the Minkowski metric. And so this is going to give me K dot V. And that's going to give me K dot V. And so I'm going to have 2 K dot V. If I add them together, then these two terms, again, are going to cancel. And I'm left with K alpha dot K alpha V beta, which, naively, there's something left over. But in fact, and so I might have thought this didn't work. But in fact, if I'm thinking about a physical graviton, K is null. And so this, because I've made that choice, this is 0. And so in fact, this does satisfy the gauge condition. So that's good. But is it an interesting solution? Any guesses? Do we like this solution?
You're looking like you have an answer.
No. Okay.
Why don't you make one choice? 50-50.
You like it?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. We like it, but on the other hand, it's trivial. So it's a good example, but it's not an interesting physical solution. The reason is because if I look at this, what I can do is I can think of K alpha as being a derivative, because when the derivative, well, this is basically a bunch of constants, and the derivative is just pulling down k's out of the exponential. And so what I can do is I can think of H alpha beta as being equal, well, there's a K alpha, so I'm going to write that. And there must be an I in there somewhere. And then similarly, there's another term. So what I've done is I've taken this, I've plugged it in here, I've stared at it, and I've said, well, I can rewrite it like this, but this is just then del alpha epsilon beta plus del beta epsilon alpha. And so I would say that what this represents is pure gauge for what I've written down here is something that's just a coordinate transformation. And so I don't think of that as a physical propagating waves. And so now we have to worry, are all of the solutions that I've written down there, are all of the solutions that satisfy this just in some sense trivial, or are there some physically interesting ones that aren't gauge transformations or aren't just coordinate changes? So in some sense, it's trivial. It's not something interesting, because we know that doing coordinate transformations isn't changing the physics. It's just changing the coordinate system. It's changing the labels on our space-time geometry. And what it hints at is that this gauge condition doesn't actually completely fix the gauge, and so there are some residual gauge degrees of freedom left with the gauge choice, width left. We're left by. And the key thing here was that the key thing was that our gauge condition was satisfied, but what I had to ensure was that the k vector was null. And so what that means is that in general, if I make a choice, if I make some choice and box of epsilon is equal to zero, that's not going to affect the Lorentz gauge choice. But what we saw in this example is it's still changing the way H alpha beta looks.
And so what that says is that we have additional degrees of freedom. We have additional choices we can make to simplify our solutions further. In particular, again, we have four functions. And so we make four choices. And so as an example, a traditional choice that we make is to set the off-diagonal components, HTI, equal to 0. That's going to be three choices, X, Y, Z. So there are three functions here that I'm setting to 0, or three functions. And so another handy function to set to 0 is just the trace of H alpha beta. So now if we go back to our plane wave, what that says is that we're making specific choices about the polarization tensor. In particular, we're saying that ATI has to be equal to 0. So ATX, ATY, ATZ, those three are all equal to 0. And also the trace, so the sum of the three or the four diagonal components of A are all going to vanish as well. Now, if we make for the purposes of illustration, if we make the special choice that our wave is propagating in the z direction, so I'm going to set the wave vector 0 in x and or the x and y components. I've just got a k and a z, and so omega, which is the magnitude of this, is just equal to k. So we're going to set those equal to 0. We also have to set our v alphas equal to 0. So for alpha equals t, what we end up with is just so I want that to be true. I've stuck T in. But one of the conditions we chose over there, using our residual transformations, is we set the trace equal to 0. So that term doesn't contribute at all. Similarly, over there, what we said is that the off-diagonal t components are also equal to 0. So the only thing that contributes here is the diagonal term. And what it says is that del t of htt, there's actually a minus sign because we're using our 8 alpha beta, is equal to 0. But if we use our plane wave ansatz, what that's saying is I k0, or minus, we keep the minus sign, I k0, or omega, or k,
times ATT is equal to 0. So we'd like to have a wave. We don't want K to be equal to 0. So what we're forced to do is we're forced to set that diagonal component equal to 0. Similarly, if I set alpha equals x, and we examine this, I won't go through any of the details, but what we're left with is just an equation that says that the z derivative of that off-diagonal component is equal to 0. And again, that's going to give us something like ik zx is equal to 0. And so again, we're finding another off-diagonal component is equal to 0 there. I can go through y. I find that azy is equal to 0. And z, I find that azz is equal to 0. So we've actually eliminated all sorts of components. We've chosen a particular wave. It's got components. Well, it's going in the z direction. It's got a frequency, so it's got a t component. So ATT and AZZ vanish. The off-diagonal terms involving z also vanish. The off-diagonal terms involving t, we set those to 0 by definition. And we also, in here, we're saying that the trace is equal to 0. So the only components of our polarization tensor that are non-vanishing are going to be the ones with x and y indices. So we're left with the following. So I'm going to explicitly write out a matrix there. So this is our polarization tensor, eta alpha beta. All of the t components were 0. All of the z components were equal to 0. And it's only these four in the middle. And so there's going to be some component in the off diagonal because it's a symmetric matrix. The same entry appears down there. And we can also have components. We can have components in the diagonal, but we know that we've set the trace equal to 0, so it has to be true that if there's an A here, the other diagonal component has to be minus A. And so what we're left with then, after all of these gauge fixing conditions, is that there are basically only two independent waves propagating, well, in any particular direction. And so here we've chosen the z direction. So this is actually kz minus t. So there was supposed to be a k dot x there. But with that choice, that's what I get. So for each k, or spatial wave vector, there are precisely two physical polarizations. For our gravity wave, or our gravitational wave. Yes.
Just trying to figure out what the subscripts were on
HFI
or something. You said you were setting the trace equal to 0.
It was HTI. So I got to make, I got to choose four more things to set to 0. So I said, let's set the off-diagonal time components to 0.
Okay.
And the other one was the trace. So there are lots of
You know, we've made a bunch of coordinate choices. There are lots of other waves I could write down in some sense, but they're trivial. They only represent changes of coordinates. And so given that we restricted all our coordinate choices in the way that I said, we have the Lorentz gauge choice, but then we also have these residual conditions that we can impose. We end up with this simple pattern here that these components of the polarization tensor that are orthogonal to the direction we're going are non-zero, but there's only really two of them because they have to be, well, there's a vanishing trace. And that's as far as I was going to take these gravitational waves. The book, well, hopefully you'll see more of it in later courses. The book discusses the physics, and in particular the production of these waves at greater length, but we just don't have time to go into that. So are there any questions about our gravitational waves? If not, I have, so I have half an hour to get through 9 pages. If I don't get to page 9, then I can't say that we've discussed something in class on your problem tonight. So let's see what happens. The first thing I'm going to do, so what we want to do is we want to introduce matter. We want to complete the Einstein equation. We've got something on the right-hand side, or the left-hand side, that's telling us about curvature, and we now want to talk about what appears on the other side of the equation. But before we do that, I have to make a diversion into some mathematics again, and here I'm just going to state I'm going to do more than state currently. I had alluded to the fact that the Riemann tensor satisfied, well, we saw that it satisfied a bunch of algebraic, if you like, identities, just switching indices around. But there's also a differential identity. For our Riemann tensor. And I didn't want to talk about it at the time because we hadn't armed ourselves yet with covariant derivatives. But now we have, and so we can ask or we can study what is the covariant derivative of the Riemann tensor. And to make some progress here, what I want to do is go to our inertial frame. Remember, or what those words mean are, we're going to make a choice. We're going to go to a particular point. We're going to make a gauge transformation that gets rid of first derivatives of the metric. And so our Christoffel symbol is vanishing. And that simplified the formula here. Well, it simplifies the formula for r, but it also simplifies this formula because now it becomes an ordinary derivative. And then there's, you know, we had some general formula for the covariant derivative of a tensor. And so there's a bunch, there's 4 extra terms, but all of these terms go to 0 because we're making this particular gauge choice. This as well involved making a particular, well, this involves derivatives of something that involves derivatives of connections and connections, and so I'm going to end up with stuff like this. But the point is, in all of these quadratic terms, well, I can't throw this away because there are derivatives of derivatives of derivatives of metric, and all we could do is eliminate the first derivative. So this is going to be non-vanishing. Here I've got another thing, the derivative of Christoffel symbol. That's going to be non-vanishing, but because it was quadratic, again, those terms all vanish. And so at the end of the day, the only contributions in this kind of expression are ones that are third derivatives. And in fact, what we can do is just write out, and I won't write out for time, the ordinary derivative times this formula that we had that made its appearance on the board a couple of times, where there are four contributions. So the Riemann tensor in the inertial frame, we could reduce down to 1/2 times something with derivative, derivative g, and then there were three other terms. And the claim here is that if I take the covariant derivative of r, again in the inertial frame, that all that amounts to doing, the only thing that I'm going to have is these third derivative terms, i.e. I take the original expression here and just take an ordinary derivative of it. So that's not in itself very enlightening, especially since I didn't bother to write out the indices. But the claim is that by cyclically permuting the indices around, we find in this expression, where all of these derivatives now commute, we can find that there's a vanishing result, or there's a particular identity. So what one can confirm is that if I take this expression and then write it out again, but again, I'm just trading indices around in these first three slots, then you add them up, what you find is that that's equal to zero. And so the claim is that that's just a very simple manipulation when you have ordinary derivatives there, and you can prove this. There's also a more, there's an exercise that I talk about in the,
Christoffel symbol equals zero, then trivially the second line is zero because we have derivative of the Christoffel symbols and product of the Christoffel symbol.
Sorry, that went by too quick. You're saying this is automatically zero?
Zero.
Why is that?
Because from up there, the Christoffel symbols are zero.
Again, this is, this thing equals zero at a particular point. So I can't say anything, though, about the derivatives of this object. But if I know a function, you know, I have a function on the plane, if I give you a boundary condition at a, on a particular line or at a point, I can't tell you what it is away from it. And so every time I see a gamma, I can set that to zero, but where I see derivatives of gamma, I can't set that equal to zero. And so this has a name, which I didn't write down for some reason, but we'll call that Yonkian unity. And as it stands, it's not going to be very useful to us, but it has implications for our Ricci tensor. Remember that R alpha R alpha beta is just the contraction so this was how we
derived or constructed the thing that appears in Einstein's vacuum equations. And I'll also remind you that our Ricci curvature is symmetric because we're going to use that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to contract this line with a G alpha mu. So if I contract with G alpha mu, well, in this line, remember that metrics or inverse metrics I can pull in and out of covariant derivatives at will. So this one contracts here just to give me a Ricci tensor. Here it contracts to give me some divergence of the Riemann tensor. Here it contracts again two indices on the Riemann tensor, but they're not the same set of indices that I have here, but I can use those identities to move the indices around a little bit. And so that again reduces down to a derivative acting on the Ricci tensor. And so you end up with a del an expression like this. There are two terms that are derivatives of the Ricci curvature. And there's one term where I still have a Riemann tensor, but the covariant derivative is contracted with it. Still not quite useful enough. So we contract again with G delta nu. Oh, and okay, so the identity up here gave us that minus sign. That's going to be important. So I'm going to contract delta nu. That's going to give me a divergence. R mu beta. I'm going to contract delta mu. That's again, a delta nu. That's again contracting two indices, and it amounts to, or it gives me a Ricci curvature. If I play around with the indices, I can put it in this form again. And the last term, I'm contracting the indices on the Ricci tensor. So I'm taking the trace of the Ricci tensor, and we'll give that a new name. We'll just call that R. And that's actually called then the Ricci scalar. So that's just the trace of our Ricci tensor. And so at the end of the day, what we have then is an identity that says that the divergence of the Ricci tensor is equal to 1/2 the gradient of the Ricci scalar, or the trace of the Ricci tensor. And so that's the important formula. Well, it's nice to know that this is around and that that's where this comes from. But this is really the important formula that we're going to use in defining the Einstein equations. Are there questions about that? Okay, so what were Einstein's equations? We had, schematically, we had something with curvature over here, and then we had something that told us about matter over here. This was going to be a symmetric tensor, because we wanted tensors worth of equations, and so we'd better write something that's a symmetric tensor over there. Um,
But then in looking at the tidal forces, what we came up with, again, motivated by or guided by what we learned from Newtonian gravity, we ended up with that equation. And if we're an observer moving around in the space-time, actually what we had is that if we contracted that with the four velocity of the observer, then this was a single equation that basically reduced down to the Newtonian equation. But now I'd like to write a more general equation. So I'm going to start with an R alpha beta there. But in fact, if I'm writing stuff with curvature here, there's another symmetric tensor that I can write down. And so I could write that down. And if I was working in the vacuum, if R alpha beta vanishes, then the trace of that matrix vanishes. And so, you know, adding this with some arbitrary constant in here wouldn't affect my equations. And so it's going to be important that we work completely generally. And so this is the most general symmetric tensor that I could write down and is consistent with our vacuum equation. To describe the curvature that appears on this side of our equation. And on the other side of the equation, again, there's going to be some constant that describes the coupling to gravity, and there's going to be some symmetric tensor that's going to describe the matrix, the matter. So so I added that, and here I'm just writing down some symmetric matrix describing matter. And for the time being, we're going to leave these constants as unknowns. Now, depending on what the matter is, this expression is going to be different. If I'm doing electromagnetism, there's some formula that one could write down. But again, we want to be guided by what we know about Newtonian gravity, and so we're going to pick a simple example of matter and try and construct the stress tensor so we can get a feeling for what's in there. And the simple example is just little particles sitting around in our space-time, and so they may be moving in some way, but they're going to move coherently, not incoherently. And they're just going to basically then have a velocity or some group velocity. And each particle has a certain mass. So and the technical term that this is always referred to is dust. So this is just a collection of particles are not interacting at all. But the idea is they fill the space-time, or they fill some region of the space-time. So they may, it's like a swarm or something, they may move around, but they'd move together. And so I'm going to characterize that motion by saying that at each point in this swarm, there's a four velocity that I can assign to the particles. Move together. So if this is an annoying definition and you don't have much feel for what I'm talking about, just think about a bunch of particles in empty space sitting there at rest. That would satisfy this definition, and it's good enough. They're just sitting there, they're not going anywhere. And so basically this four velocity across my swarm would just be a constant pointing in the time direction. On the other hand, if I was an observer that was running by this cloud of particles, then I would assign to them a collective four velocity, where rather than just sitting there, I'd see them all moving in one direction or another. And so that's enough, or if you want a simple picture, it's enough just to think of a bunch of particles sitting there at rest. And as well as their motion, though, the other thing I want to characterize the dust by is the density of particles. So there's some function that can vary. It'll be zero outside the cloud of dust. It'll be have some profile inside our cloud. And well, I should add a comment here. So what we'll find is that different people are going to assign a different density to the cloud depending on our relative motion. And so when I assign this density, I'm going to say that it's, I'm going to put a subscript here and say it's the density observed by someone who's sitting there or moving with the cloud. So if I have just particles at rest, it's an observer who just sits there and doesn't move with respect to the cloud. And so this is that O, or that subscript, is it says it's the density observed by someone moving with the cloud. And the last thing I use to characterize it, the cloud is that each particle has a mass. So if I wanted to talk about the energy density or what's going to source the gravitational field, I'd just take, or the natural thing to do is just take the density of particles times the mass. So But this, of course, is going to be what somebody would use in the Newton's equations if they were sitting at rest, say, in the middle of the cloud or in the rest frame of the cloud. What we want for our relativistic or our covariant equations is actually to build a symmetric tensor. And so how do we incorporate this into a symmetric tensor? So what we want is we want a symmetric tensor, and it's naturally going to be proportional to the rho. That's the density of the mass, at least in the rest frame. Do we have any suggestions as to what I could do to turn that into a tensor? Sorry? So there are two symmetric tensors, and Nima suggests that one of them is, I guess, take a U alpha U beta, because that four velocity was something that I said characterized the behavior of the dust, or it characterized my cloud of particles. Is there another symmetric tensor around that I could use? So the other natural thing to write down is just G alpha beta. And a priori, I don't know. All I've told you is I want a symmetric tensor. And so a priori, it could be any linear combination of those two. But our motivation over here was that I should write down this mass density for the particle. And if I, I can ask, what is energy density observed? Is I have an observer who's moving with the same four velocity, and so what they would measure is the contraction with their four velocity, and so I can contract it and I get something proportional to rho, and for both of these I'm going to get just a constant, because you contract, these are the same four velocities in this case. And so U contracted with U is just minus 1. So the first term gives me an A. The second one, there happens to be a minus sign. But what that's saying is this choice is consistent with the idea that an observer sitting there in the cloud is going to see something proportional to this. So this particular choice is consistent with this idea, or this idea, that if I'm sitting there in the cloud, the natural source for Newton's equations are going to be this energy density. But we still have to figure out how do we fix those particular numbers.
Sorry.
Yeah?
Why is this the energy density?
Okay.
So to really understand where that was coming from, I have to go back to our discussion about geodesic deviation and the origin of where did we come up with our vacuum field equation? If you remember, we had actually a matrix. Recall our derivation of the vacuum. So there we actually came up with a matrix that described the deviation between the geodesics. And motivated by Newton's equations, what we said is that Newton's equations, or the analog, because that would be the analog of del squared phi equals zero. But then I complained that, well, what we had really wanted was a tensor's worth of equations. And what we noticed was that even though this is just a number, in there was hidden the core velocity of the observer, of our reference observer. And so this was going to be Newton's equations, but for a particular observer. So this was giving us Newton's equation, or was giving us the left-hand side of Newton's equations for a particular observer. At the time, the emphasis was on finding a covariant equation. And so what I said is that, well, this should apply for any observer. I should be able to apply this equation for any observer. And so the natural thing to do was focus on this and say the vacuum equation was just that. But now I want to use this analog going back to, you know, thinking of what we're doing is extending Newton's equations. And so the way that we identified Newton's equations was with this projection. And so the idea is that using that projection is also going to identify the source on the other side. But the idea is that should be proportional then to this projection to a particular, so that's not an index, that's just saying proportional to, so this source, the mass density should be proportional, or the energy density should be proportional to this particular projection of the stress tensor. And so that's what I'm doing here. I'm saying the natural thing that we're seeing for observers who are sitting at rest in the cloud is exactly this mass density that we talked about. But we had an ambiguity at this point in deciding
how to build a symmetric tensor. And with, you know, well, I can choose appropriate linear combinations, or A and B are still to be fixed. Are people happy with that? Relatively happy. Okay, so that was an aside to explain this point here. But I'd like to fix, I'd like to get an idea what A and B am I really supposed to fix there. And so let's think about an observer not, or observers not sitting at rest in the cloud, but let's think of observers that are moving at some fixed velocity with respect to the cloud. And what are they going to see? And so I'll say they have a four-velocity capital V. Super alpha, if I use this same projection for them, now I'm going to get something, again, proportional to rho. But I'm going to get two terms with V dot U, and I'll get another term with V dot V. But V dot V, that's a four velocity, so that's just going to be minus one. And so there are two contributions, A times U dot V squared minus V. And so that minus sign is just V dot V. But, well, that's a pretty symbol, but to really understand it, let's write out the components and let's write out what we have there. So let's write the cloud as just sitting there. So we're in a frame where that cloud is, well, the four velocity is just 1, 0, 0, 0. This person's moving with respect to the cloud. And so there's some three velocity there. And there's effectively a one here, but then we have to put in the square root or the gamma factors on both of those terms. And so if I take then U dot V, what I'm just getting is this, well, up to a minus sign, I'm just getting the 1 minus square root of V squared. And so what we're finding here is that T alpha, V beta, is equal to rho, and then there's a factor of A over this thing squared, so A over 1 minus V squared. And then the other term was just the same as in our previous calculation, it was just a minus 1. So now by going to this frame that's moving with respect to the cloud, I'm distinguishing these two terms. This term is just a constant. It didn't change, didn't depend on the, or that contribution didn't depend on this velocity at all. And this actually, this term is changing. It's increasing. And it's actually, though, got a factor of gamma squared in it. So the question is, if I think now about the physics, you know, which one of these choices seems to be the appropriate choice? Or which linear combination should I expect is the appropriate choice? Yeah.
supposed to be a free power plant in which connection is zero?
I'm really thinking of this linearized limit, and so I'm cheating a little bit. I'm just writing things as though they were in Minkowski space. And so there's some matter there, but it's producing a small field, and we're going to ignore that for this calculation. So
what's the reasonable or the right choice? So our particles are all moving with respect to these new observers, and so their energy, so if the cloud's sitting here and I'm moving through them, or if I'm sitting at rest, if I think I'm in my sitting in my lab, the cloud's moving by, the particles are all moving, and so each particle has a mass m, but the energy density there is actually enhanced by a gamma factor. And so the relativistic is actually m over the square root of 1 minus v squared. So that's suggesting that the energy density should be going up. But it's only going up, or that m is only going up with a gamma factor. Whereas here I'm writing actually gamma squared. And so that doesn't seem to quite match. But that's because what's written here is not just the mass, but it's a mass density. And so we should also think about not just the mass or the energy of each particle, but we should think about the density of the particles in this when they're moving in this other frame. So we started with our original frame. I'm going to divide it up into some small boxes. So there's delta x, delta y, delta z. And there's some number of particles in that box. It's just NO. Delta x, delta y, delta z. So that's in the original frame. And what we're going to see is that n, or the effective density, changes in the other frame. And that's why I took the time to put this subscript and add a few words about what it means. So this is the number of particles in that box. I'll call that some little delta n, because it's the density times some infinitesimal little volume. Now I'm thinking of the V frame, or the second frame. Now my little box is moving with a velocity V. Or actually, I guess it's moving with a velocity minus V in this frame. And let's say that it's moving along the y-axis, or what I've written as the y-axis. What that means is that the orthogonal directions in the box are going to be the same. So the delta z and the delta x
are going to be the same in both of those pictures, but the delta y, the length along the velocity, is going to change. And so I have to write a delta y prime there. And in fact, well, now we're just talking about special relativity. I have length contraction, and so delta y prime compared to that original delta y is just a factor, or it's shorter by a factor of square root of 1 minus v squared. So what are we doing? We're saying imagine moves So we're imagining that the dust moves in the second frame with a velocity v along the y-axis, delta x and delta z, the orthogonal directions, or the lengths of the box in the orthogonal directions are unchanged. But here we have length contraction. Along the y direction. So the delta y prime is changed. But of course, you know, I counted, there were delta n, or there were 10 particles in that box. I go to this frame, there are still 10 particles, so there's still the same particles in that same box. So we're almost there. We have to remember what I just erased, unfortunately. But what that says then is that the density is n over delta x, delta z, delta y prime. But that's delta n then. And an extra square root of 1 minus v squared. But this then, that was the original density. And so what's happened is that in going between the two frames, two things happen. One is there are relativistic effects. There's more energy density in the box. But the box is also contracting, so the density of particles is changing. And so both of those two effects combine so that the rho prime is the energy of each of the particles times the new density. And so that's so what, well, what this heuristic explanation explains then is that we should have expected that the source for our gravitational, our gravitational field should have increased in this exact way. And so if we remember the equation that I wrote down on that board, well, you can just see it. There was one term that was behaving in the right way and one term that was behaving in the wrong way. And so I'm going to discard that term. So that was the term that was proportional to g alpha beta. And I'm going to keep this term. This was the term that was proportional to u alpha u beta. So I'll just stick in a equals 1. And so for our dust cloud, then, it seems that the right choice for a stress energy tensor is then this combination. This mass density in the rest frame times this product of two four velocities, again, the four velocities of our cloud of dust. So we'll put a box around that equation. And then I will say, a miracle occurs fixing lambda equals minus 1/2. We'll have to come back to that next day, but what that says then is our Einstein equation is going to be equal to this. So this statement is that I want to stick a minus 1/2 in there. I've run out of time to tell you why. But then I'm going to tell you, well, how would I decide what that kappa is? That kappa is telling me about the coupling between our geometry and our matter. And again, what I'm going to do is I'm going to refer back to Einstein's or Newtonian gravity. We've got this recipe that what I should do is I should project this equation with U alpha. And the simplest thing to do is project it with an observer sitting at rest in our cloud of dust. And so that's making a certain projection here. And it's projecting out a certain piece of T alpha beta. We have our Newtonian metric. And so we can look at the linearized field equation or see what we're getting on this side of the equation. It's going to look like Newton's del squared. So on this side, we get del squared. On that side, we're going to get something with a rho. And the question is, what goes in the middle? And the claim is, well, Newton told us what goes in the middle. There's a 4 pi g in there. And so you just have to make sure that all the numbers work out in this equation so that what's appearing is Newton's equation for the gravitational field. I guess I project with this. And so that was the exercise that I'd asked you to think about tonight. And unfortunately, this miracle will have to wait until tomorrow. But this is the starting point of the exercise, and this is basically what I'm asking you to do. Are there any questions? Sorry? Okay. Dennis wants lunch.